Today, with all the talk of big media and fake news, it's easy to forget the role pioneering journalists like Ida B. Wells once played. Here's writer and activist Mariam Kaba.
The reason we understand lynching to be a form of racial terror rather than an appropriate way to handle crime is that Ida B. Wells helped us to make the connection between the fact that people weren't actually being lynched for the reasons that people were saying.
We learn more about Ida B. Wells and her Illinois roots, as well as an attempt by her great-granddaughter to have the city of Chicago create a monument in her honor. Plus, award-winning author and anthropologist Amitabh Ghosh joins us to talk about the disconnect between climate change and culture. He says we may well look back on this era as a time of great derangement. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started just after this news update. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The way to right wrongs is to turn the light of truth upon them. Those are the words of Ida B. Wells, a pioneering investigative journalist who is also one of the founders of the NAACP. She was born into slavery in Mississippi in 1862, but she moved to Memphis and eventually to Chicago. And she was known not just for her journalism, which included documenting the many cases of lynching in the American South. She also fought for the right for women to vote. And as I mentioned, was one of the founders of the NAACP. Her story is one of many in Chicago that's being kept alive by a new generation of activists and writers. And we're going to be talking about that this hour on the 21st. I'd like to start with Michelle Duster. She's the great-granddaughter of Ida B. Wells, and she's on the line from Chicago. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
Lolly Bowen is also with us. She's a reporter with the Chicago Tribune who covers the south side of Chicago. Lolly, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Michelle, can I start by asking, what did your family teach you about your great-grandmother?
Pretty much what you just said, that she was a journalist, that she fought for justice, that she wrote about things that were, I mean, you know, it depends on the age that I was. When I was, you know, younger, way younger, you know, they were pretty vague about it as far as the level of atrocities that she wrote about. But as I got older, you know, then I became more aware of exactly how violent things were that she was dealing with.
Can I ask you about her childhood? As I mentioned, she was born actually in Mississippi in 1862 during the Civil War, just a couple months actually before the Emancipation Proclamation. And I wanted to just ask how that and the end of the Civil War affected her family in her childhood.
I think it affected them significantly. If you think about the fact that her parents had been slaves their entire lives and then were free, that her father was a carpenter, and so after slavery ended, he was able to, you know, work for himself as a carpenter, and her mother was a cook. So same thing, they became more like entrepreneurs. They also, as a result of slavery ending, were able to become educated. So my great-grandmother was the first of that generation, that entire generation that was born around that time, to have the opportunity to become formally educated, legally educated. And her mother actually went to school with her because she was not literate at the time. So in multiple ways, I mean, going from being a piece of property to actually being a free person is a major change.
And then when she was around 15 or 16, she lost her parents to yellow fever. Can you tell us what she had to do to also to take care of her siblings and keep your family together?
Right. Both of her parents died when she was 16. And one of her younger siblings died as well. So she was left with five siblings. And she was 16 years old, and there was talk of having her siblings divided among friends of the family. And from what I heard, my great-grandmother refused to have that happen. She was the oldest of all of them. And she decided that she would make herself look older and become a teacher. So that's what she did in order to keep her family together. From what I understand, the reason why she wanted to do that is because she had grown up hearing stories about from her mother about her mother had been sold as a slave when she was 7 and never saw her parents or siblings again. So, you know, Ida didn't want that to happen to her and her siblings.
It's such a remarkable life that your great-grandmother had. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about was one of the things that she became known for. She did a lot of, she was in some ways, somewhat people look to her as the pioneer of investigative journalism. There's also a lot of journalism she did around the many lynchings that were taking place throughout the South. What do you know about when she first became interested in documenting this?
From what I understand, she became interested in 1892 when 3 of her friends were lynched. She lived in Memphis, and from what I understand, lynchings were not very common in urban areas. And so she heard about them, but the major newspapers at the time, you know, the quote, you know, mainstream media was basically, you know, having that storyline of the men who had been lynched were guilty of crimes. And so she didn't have any other information about that. But when her friends were killed, she realized that they were not guilty of the crime that a lot of people were being accused of. And so it made her want to know how many other lynchings that had taken place were under false pretenses as well. So that really set her off, that lynching of her friend.
I wanted to just play a little bit of Oprah Winfrey at a new monument documenting lynchings. This is her getting a tour of this monument.
And then you get to this corridor, and this is when you begin to confront the scale of all of these lynchings.
Whoa. This is something.
Yes, yes. We wanted people to have a sense of just the scale of what this violence, what this terrorism was.
So this is over 4,000 that have been documented, but of course there are more.
Thousands more. Thousands more.
Thousands more. And will we ever even know how many?
We will never know.
The audio is courtesy of 60 Minutes, Oprah Winfrey talking about lynchings. Lolly, we're speaking with Michelle Duster, who's the great-granddaughter of Ida B. Wells, and Lolly Bowen, a reporter from the Chicago Tribune. Lolly, can I ask you just about the journalism side of this? What's your sort of your experience of how the mainstream media, which obviously would have been the white media at that point, covered these issues?
The media at the time was racially segregated and divided. And so we had a mainstream press that, as you said, was a white press that did not really cover or give depth or deep coverage to issues that were facing the black community or covered violence that was taking place against African-American communities. And this was the time that Ida B. Wells began to sort of cut her teeth as a journalist. And she decided pretty early on that she wanted to write specifically about black people and some of the struggles that they were enduring post-emancipation as black people were essentially trying to secure civil rights and trying to share their stories of what they were enduring in an effort to obtain full citizenship in the country in which they were born.
Michelle, as we think about that, I wonder if you can share with our audience what ultimately brought Ida B. Wells to Chicago and what kind of work she did in Chicago as well.
Well, I mean, as you said, she was living in Memphis, working as a teacher, and then eventually she ended up focusing only on journalism after she lost her job as a teacher because she wrote about the unfair working conditions in the teaching profession, the segregated teaching profession. So when she was focused on journalism, and after she wrote that article about the real reason why lynching was taking place, which was to terrorize the African American community and make it difficult for the people to thrive. I mean, because they were targeting business owners and leaders of the community. So she was never able to return to Memphis. She was out of town when that article was printed, which I really think was intentional on her part. And so then she was threatened, her life was threatened, and she never went back to Memphis. Also, her printing press was destroyed. So she ultimately went up to New York and worked with T. Thomas Fortune for a little while. Then she went on a speaking tour to England, and she ultimately came to Chicago at the request of Frederick Douglass to work on a pamphlet to protest the exclusion of African Americans from the World's Fair. And she ended up staying in Chicago eventually because she got married to one of the other writers for that pamphlet, whose name was Ferdinand Barnett.
Michelle, how would you, I should mention, you are an educator yourself. You're a professor at Columbia College, Chicago. How do you think we should think about her work, both as a journalist and an activist, as you mentioned, in the context of other Black leaders of the time, names that perhaps might be more well-known, like Frederick Douglass or W.E.B. Du Bois?
I mean, I think that if people figure out a way to that understand that there was a community, there were thought leaders at that time the same way they are today. When you think about, I mean, we could name some people today that, you know, are talking, you know, heads on different talk shows and things like that. I mean, they had the same thing then. They had conventions and panel discussions and all kinds of activities at that time. My great-grandmother was one of those people along with Du Bois and Frederick Douglass. She was one of their peers to an extent. I mean, Frederick Douglass was older than her, but she was a little older than Du Bois. So there were several people all at that time who were equivalent to what we have today. I think that she might have been a little overshadowed because she was a woman. But she was definitely in the same place at the same time as those guys.
Lolly, in your experience, how well-known do you think Ida B. Wells is, even within Chicago?
You know, that's a tricky question for me. I went to a journalism school at a historically Black college, Howard University, and so we were introduced to Ida B. Wells as a pioneer, not just in journalism, but in investigative journalism very early on. In Chicago, her name continued to ring out because there was a public housing complex that bore her name. So it's hard for me to really gauge accurately how much people know her and know her legacy. It's always a surprise to me when I meet younger people or even, you know, my contemporaries who don't have a sense of the work that she did, the way that she contributed, not just to Chicago, but to the nation and the world. So it's kind of hard for me to gauge how much people actually know about her. But I will say that one of the great things that Ida B. Wells did was she documented her own story, and she thought that it was important to record her thoughts and her experiences so that her legacy could continue. And so I hope that with the publication of the New York Times obituary and the efforts of some Black feminists to kind of give more attention to her name, and Michelle Destor's push to have a memorial place in Chicago that would honor her in a more rightful way, will kind of ramp up even more public interest in not just her work and her legacy, but her as a woman and as an activist and as a leader.
Michelle, I wanted to end by asking you about that, about a monument that you would like to see of your great-grandmother in the Bronzeville neighborhood of Chicago. Why is that so important to you? How would you like to see her legacy more reflected in public places in Chicago?
For some of the same reasons that Lolly mentioned, when the housing community was first built in 1941, it was a great honor for it to be named after my great-grandmother because she lived in the community, and the people who lived in that community are the ones who, from what I understand, requested that it be named after her. So at the time, it was really a great honor, and it was a beautiful place to live. It was a major step up from the slums that, you know, people were living in. But, I mean, it stood for over 60 years, and as time went on, you know, there are a lot of dynamics that, you know, contributed to the fact that the community ended up being notorious for a lot of things that were negative. So when the community was eliminated, my concern was that her name would start to be unknown in the city. And I felt that one of the things that was important for, was to kind of reclaim her as a woman versus the name of a community. I think that who she was and what she stood for was sort of getting lost in being associated with a community. So I think that having a public piece of work that shows her image and has excerpts from some of her work and some of her biographical information will be a much more clear representation of who she was as a woman. And I think that will help people know the information and hopefully be inspired by somebody who has her life story.
Michelle, I want to thank you for taking the time to share with us a little bit more about your great-grandmother, Ida B. Wells. Lolly Bowen has also been with us, a reporter from the Chicago Tribune. Both of you, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about the life and legacy of Ida B. Wells, one of the most prominent Black women in the history of Chicago. And when you think of famous Black women from Chicago, Ida B. Wells is just one of many. I'm thinking about Gwendolyn Brooks or Lorraine Hansberry. And now two women in Chicago are working to make sure the public remembers those women and more women throughout history in Chicago. They're joining me now. Mariam Kaba is an organizer, educator, and founder of the nonprofit group Project NIA, which works to end youth incarceration. Essence McDowell is also with us. She works as a digital artist and communication strategist, and together they co-wrote the book Lifting as They Climbed, Mapping a History of Black Women on Chicago's South Side, a self-guided tour. Chicago Tribune Lolly Bowen is also still with us. She went on that tour and reported on it for the paper. Mariam, Essence, thanks for being with me. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much.
Mariam, can we start with the name of your book? It's called Lifting as They Climbed. Can you explain what that name means to you and where it comes from?
The name comes from basically the club women of the early 20th century, late 19th century. It was based on a book that was published in the 1930s that was called Lifting as They Climb by a woman named Elizabeth Davis, who was part of the National Association of Colored Women, which was the first national Black organization in the U.S. that worked around issues of Black women that was run by Black women. So basically that was it's the title of that book, and it speaks to how club women of that period saw themselves as people who were doing racial uplift work.
In essence, what motivated you to want to work on this book with Mariam?
So Mariam, she did a presentation with a group of women, Black women who came together, and she was talking about the project, and instantly upon hearing about the women, I just really compelled. I hadn't heard the stories before. I also, not being from Chicago, I'm from New Jersey, so I hadn't had the background on many of these locations that we're referring to. So it wasn't just the immense contributions Black women have made into the city, but it was also just these landmarks that are everywhere around us that I had no idea existed. I've literally walked through some of these buildings. And so just these stories and my situation within Chicago just compelled me to take on the project with Miriam. It's just so powerful.
Lolly, what did you learn from the tour? You took it recently.
Yes. Well, you know, one of the great things that I learned, almost as Essence alludes to, is just this rich history and all of these wonderful sites that were building grounds for African-American women on Chicago's South Side, and how these women, from very modest means, during a really violent and tormenting time, were able to build organizations and households and families and activism at a time when it was so desperately needed for Black people, not just in the city of Chicago, but in our entire nation.
Mariam, you have almost 50 locations on this tour. How did you decide who to pick and what to pick?
Well, you know, this is a project I've been working on for many years, and I had been working on it on and off. You know, every time I would see a story or a name, I would try to, you know, keep it in mind. When Essence and I finally came together at the end of last year to start thinking about how to lay out this book and what might be included, we basically had a number of criteria. One of them is obviously that the women we featured had a significant impact on Chicago so that we could actually tell a story about her and her life. The second was that we could actually find and tie her to a particular landmark or site. And if we couldn't find a landmark or site that directly had her imprint on it, then we really didn't put her in the book. And then we also were really interested in whether or not some of these sites actually still exist or if they have some actual landmarks that are still on it. Because a lot, as you know, Chicago is a city of change, constant change. Communities that were inhabited by certain groups of people are no longer inhabited by those groups. We are in a constant kind of redevelopment stage all the time. And so we didn't want to have people stand in a bunch of fields or places where there's nothing to look at or nothing to see. So that also had an impact on how it is that we wanted to, you know, kind of feature stories of particular women.
And there aren't, Mariam, there aren't official markers on any of these places, are there?
No, you know, some of the buildings were designated as landmarks. So, for example, Margaret Burroughs's home is a landmark site, and that was where she started the DuSable in the first place. Quinn Chapel is a landmark site. So there are a few places like that where the city has actually designated it landmark status, and then even the federal government has come in. For example, in the South Side Arts Center is in the process of becoming a national landmark. So in those cases, there are markers. In a couple of cases, like, for example, Lillian Armstrong, the second wife of Louis Armstrong, in front of her house is a marker that the city put up that's not landmark, but it was a partnership that they had with the Chicago Tribune Foundation, like in the 1990s, where they tried to put some poles, like, you know, literally like a pole on the street that had I think people have seen that if they walked by certain sites, which had a little plaque with some information. The same is in front of Ida B. Wells's home. But, you know, there are a few places like that, but many of these sites don't have markers, are places that you walk by every day and you don't really know the history of them. You don't know who lived there. You don't know who loved there, who had any sort of impact on the city there. So this book is in part to try to put those markers back for the places that people don't know.
Essence, I wonder if there's some women who you learned about and thought, I can't believe more people don't know about her.
I mean,
all of them.
All of them. But, you know, I think every week, you know, just rereading the book and really learning more and more about these women, that I'm just falling in love with that. Women, I'm just like, they're so powerful. I would say Thyra Edwards. She was a social worker, teacher, journalist, labor organizer. She did a lot of casework and for like Illinois State University institutions. And then she also was an international foreign correspondent. She helped with the Abraham Lincoln Center, so she advocated for employment opportunities for Black Chicago communities. Thyra Edwards is one of them. I think also Addie Wyatt. She was a labor and civil rights activist and leader. She was one of the first women elected to the United Packing House Workers of America. She was an ordained minister. She also was a civil rights activist who worked with Martin Luther King. Eleanor Roosevelt also appointed her to the U.S. Commissions on the Status of Women. I think another woman that comes to mind that really fascinated me because I went to Bethune-Cookman University, and Marjorie Stewart Joyner. She was a salon stylist. She was an entrepreneur. She basically worked with Madam C.J. Walker to help expand her brand. She helped open over 200 beauty schools. And it wasn't just like the hair stylist aspect of her life. She also co-founded Cosmopolitan Church with Mary Evans and worked with Robert Abbott to like do the Bud Billiken parade. And so what I realized with a lot of these women that it wasn't just like some of the things you hear, like, oh, they were activists or they were like a singer. They actually did so much. They not only were a part of such talented like lifestyles, but they built institutions. They worked together to build community power and foster Black solidarity. They just had such complex and dynamic lives that were so rich that it was really hard to even just summarize their lives in the guidebook. So I think a lot of the hope is that people read these short snippets of their lives and become really curious, and that it incites like not only an awareness of their lives, but just like a inspiration, because they were so dynamic and powerful in what they were able to accomplish in their lives, but also what they were able to build for future generations.
And as you say that, Mariam, I wanted to just ask you about these stories, just the fact that a lot of these stories, and these are women whose stories up until this point haven't probably been heard very much of, or I don't want to say that they've been lost, but they haven't been heard from. And how important do you think it is, as we look back on history now, to realize that there are so many voices that have been lost previously?
Yeah, I think that's so important. A big part of this project, I see it as both a memorialization of the work that was done, an attempt to make sure that we combat the erasure of Black women's labor, both their kind of physical labor that they've always put into this country, their reproductive labor, but also their intellectual labor. You know, a lot of these women that we feature in the book are strategists, they're organizers, they're educators, and they're thinkers. They've helped us to rethink very important things. You talked about Ida B. Wells Barnett earlier, and, you know, I think Ida B. Wells Barnett's work is now getting more known around her journalism. She's really one of the pioneering first sociologists. You know, the reason we understand lynching to be a form of racial terror rather than an appropriate way to handle crime is that Ida B. Wells helped us to make the connection between the fact that people weren't actually being lynched for the reasons that people were saying, that in fact the people who were more likely to be lynched were people who were successful Black people, because it was a way to terrorize not just them and keep them in their place and control them, but it was also a message to the broader community. If you get out of your pocket, if you are somebody who takes yourself too seriously, if you become too uppity, we have the power to kill you. And so it was, you know, that kind of insight, her insight around interracial relationships, you know, saying out loud at a time when people didn't talk about sex and sexual relations, saying very explicitly and clearly, a lot of these men that are being lynched were having actual relationships with white women that were consensual, right? And speaking about that out loud, saying things like, if rape was actually the reason for why you were lynching Black men, why are white men not being lynched for their rapes of Black women? So she's an anti-rape activist and organizer way before even the work that Danielle McGuire tells us about Rosa Parks doing in the 1940s in Recy Taylor's case. So it's really important for us to understand the fullness of Black women's work, of our contributions, not just to this country or this city, but to the world. And our book is an attempt to begin those conversations with people. So we really want people to help us to make sure that the book becomes a digital hub. We want them to go to ChicagoWomenTour.com and, you know, buy the book, read it, take the tour. That most importantly for us, this is a self-guided tour book. It is not a history book. We want people to read these stories, go and investigate themselves, but as importantly, we want them to walk the city, to leave their part of the city, if they're from the north side or from the west side, to come to the south side and look at these buildings and these sites and these landmarks, hear the stories of these women, and get curious and learn, want to learn much more. So that's our goal.
Lolly, as Mariam's saying that, what was it like when you went on the tour? What did local residents, what was the response?
Well, I think the response for people who got to actually kind of walk the path is just one of inspiration and amazement. I think it's important to point out that the women that they have chronicled in their book, Essence and Mariam, they're writing about them some 100 years or nearly 100 years after they've completed their work or their lives have ended. And they were doing this work during a time when there was no social media, there was no Facebook, there was very little attention that was paid to them. And so in some ways, the work that they were doing was a little thankless. Outside of the community's sort of small recognition, they were doing it specifically in response to community need and to advance African Americans in this country. And so in some ways, being able to walk the path and see where they built and where they landed when they came to Chicago and the modest means from which they were able to do such great work, it's inspiring, it's compelling. In some ways, when I heard some of the stories, like of Fannie Emanuel, who moved to Chicago, started a rooming house to help groom African American single mothers and girls, and then after the age of 40, decided to go back to school and become a physician. You know, when you hear those types of stories of people in the early 1900s, it really does make you wonder what you're doing with your own life.
It's really remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Essence, can I ask you one last question? I know for you and for Mariam, I think one of the goals here is also that people see these Black women and their three-dimensional lives and not just through a context of suffering. Why do you think that's so important?
I think because during this time, they were a part of a city that was not built to sustain Black life or support Black life, and they didn't necessarily see these as oppressive forces and that stopped them. They didn't stop. They built things. They built institutions. They built schools. They built centers. They really took it upon themselves to just blossom instead of, like, you know, shrink in the face of all of these challenges on a social, political, and economic level. I think a lot of the women also are artists. They created. They took what they saw. They took the things that were coming against them, and they then made something more beautiful and something more powerful. It's not about oppression. It's about the ways in which Black women have taken all of the tools and all of the resources that they have for themselves to like transform Black communities and to transform Black life for like everyone around them. So it's a really uplifting story. They really are lifting as they climbed, and we want people to be excited and inspired and to stand in front of these landmarks and locations and really breathe in the power that these women exuded throughout their lives.
You can do that. The book is Lifting as They Climbed, Mapping a History of Black Women on Chicago South Side, a self-guided tour. I want to thank the authors, Mariam Kaba, Essence McDowell, also Chicago Tribune, Lolly Bowen, who went on the tour and wrote about it. Ladies, thank you very much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thanks for tuning into this encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Is our culture truly coming to grips with climate change? That's a question asked by award-winning novelist Amitav Ghosh. In his most recent nonfiction book, The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable, he explores our inability to grasp what he calls the scale and violence of climate change. We had a chance to catch up with Amitav in April when he was the keynote speaker at the Illinois 150 conference, and I started by asking him about his book, The Hungry Tide.
The Hungry Tide is about, it's a novel that's set in the Sundarbans. The Sundarbans is this vast mangrove forest in the Gangetic Delta. That is, it's in Bengal, really. Bengal is, in fact, really this delta which has been created by the river Ganges and the river Brahmaputra. It's a huge, huge delta, and there's this enormous mangrove forest there. It's a completely unique ecosystem. It's one of the world's most amazing landscapes. And I have a long connection with the Sundarbans because an uncle of mine lived there all his life and so on. So because of that, I wanted to set a novel there. And I started visiting the Sundarbans, in a sort of very systematic way, just seeing what there was over there. And it was then that I really became aware of the scale and impact of climate change, you know. And this I'm talking about, 2001, 2002. So a really long time ago. I mean, before that, I wouldn't say that I paid much attention to climate change. But once I was there, it became very evident, that sea level rise was claiming more and more land that had once been cultivated. Seawater was coming further and further inland. We could see islands. I mean, you can literally see islands going underwater. So the impacts in that region are truly terrifying, hundreds of thousands of people have been driven away from their villages, and they're now sort of like penniless people who are who've spread out, across India.
Displaced.
Displaced people, yes.
And when you think about that, our listeners know I'm originally from Florida, and I was just on vacation back in Miami, and it struck me how much a conversation rising sea levels are that's happening in Miami. And I know of people who are literally selling their homes because it's too close to the water. That's not the majority opinion, I wouldn't say, in Miami. But I wonder, especially as we think about people who, even for people who are directly affected by this, do you think that people are making the connection between how much climate change is really having an impact on our lives on a daily basis?
No, I would say people are very far from understanding, what's actually already occurring. And I'm very happy to hear about your friends in Miami because, I mean, obviously they're ahead of the curve. But in fact, if you look at the real estate prices in Miami, if you look at just any
waterfront real estate, right?
Exactly.
Anywhere in the world,
the values keep rising. Everyone is desperate to have a sea view. So, I mean, if there are actually people in Miami who are making this connection, I think they're very wise people. But in fact, most people are still making extremely unwise decisions, to move closer and closer to the water, to move into these areas, like Miami Beach and so on, which are directly threatened. And it's not just in America. I see this constantly in India, in the big Indian cities now. Many of them are actually waterfront cities. People are building closer and closer to the water. And it's just a disaster waiting to happen. And actually, it's not waiting to happen. It happens constantly. We have these incredible floods. Cities are just completely swamped. And then 10 days later, people somehow survive and then they forget and they just go on,
Why do you think that is? You wrote something when The Great Derangement first came out. You said, our climate crisis is also a crisis of culture and thus of imagination. Do you think that's still the case? You wrote that 2 years ago. Do you think we're still not really fully coming to grips with this in terms of how we deal with our culture?
Yes, certainly. I mean, I think certainly climate change is more present in our culture now than it was maybe 3-4 years ago. And that's certainly true of America. But if I look at, say, culture in India or in Asia, there's very little discussion of climate change. If I look at recent books that have come out of India, novels, etc., climate change is completely absent. I think in a weird way, that's true far beyond, I mean, you look at, say, something like Hurricane Sandy, you know, which hit New York and which clearly has some sort of climate change fingerprint upon it. I mean, it wasn't caused by climate change, as they say, but it was intensified by climate change, you could say. New York has so many writers, so many artists, but there are very few books in which climate change figures, you know. For novels, I believe there are one or two. As for art, I don't know. I really haven't seen much work which features Hurricane Sandy. So, you know, these things are happening to us. Even as we speak, they're happening right now. But in some strange way, they're absent from culture.
It sounds like there's an absence not just among people who are dealing with this, but also among artists. So let's talk about artists and writers. Why do you think that this isn't something? You've been a writer for more than 30 years, and it's now after 30 years that this has come to you to write about this as well.
Very much so. And actually, that's what my book is about. My book, in a sense, is The Great Derangement, is a kind of introspection, if you like. It's a self-scrutiny. I'm trying to understand what it is in the forms with which I work, forms like the novel or even nonfiction, that actually resists, issues like climate change. Because, you know, we like to think that that artists and writers are somehow ahead of culture, if you like, you know, that we have, we've seen what other people haven't seen. And yet, when we look at the issue of climate change, which is perhaps the most it is certainly the most pressing issue of our time, what we actually see is that writers have actually been quite slow to respond to climate change. And that's a curious thing, because it's not, if you consider, for example, a writer like John Steinbeck, The Grapes of Wrath, in some sense, it is a climate change novel. The opening chapter of Grapes of Wrath is it's all about climate change. It's a magnificent piece of work. So if a writer like John Steinbeck could write about these issues 50, 60 years ago, the question then arises, why is it that we are not able to respond in this way? And I think that really brings it down to the directions that art and literature have taken since the 60s. They've become more and more concerned with certain kinds of issues, which you might call issues of interiority. So when we read a book now, we really want to hear about what the person thinks about themselves, or their relationships with others. We are really not that interested in their relationship with the world around them.
And what do you think artists and writers can bring to this discussion of climate change that is different? Because I think when we think about people in public life, certainly politicians, Vice President Al Gore has done it. Actually, he's brought his film. He actually went to the realm of art to talk about this. How do you think writers and artists can bring something that's different to this discussion?
I think writers and artists can just help place it at the center of our imagination, you know, because, I mean, that's really what we need at this moment, just to find ways of thinking about it, you know, and speaking about it and talking about it. There's a wonderful climate change communicator called Catherine Hayhoe. She's a scientist and she's a deeply religious, a Christian and so on. And she says that the most important thing we can do in relation to climate change is just to talk about it. And it's a strange thing. I don't know if you've ever tried to talk about climate change at a dinner party, for example.
But kind of a conversation stopper. Yes. Have you tried to do this?
I do it all the time. And I did it to my poor children, you know, when they were little even. So they've done actually, sort of sociological studies. And they found that the quickest way to end a dinner table conversation is to bring up climate change. That has to stop. You know, we have to be able to talk about these things in a normal way.
My guest is Amitav Ghosh. His most recent nonfiction book is called The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable. Do you think that part of this is also just because it is such a vastly complex problem that sometimes gets oversimplified to maybe the earth is getting hotter, or we have more of these natural disasters? Do you think that part of it is just that it is a really complex problem to understand?
It is certainly that it's an enormously complex thing, and it's talking about very large issues. But, you know, if you think back on human history, human beings have always confronted very complex issues and spoken about them. You know, you think about let's say the Bible, you know, which begins with images of the earth being made and so on. And there are lots of terrible climate disasters like the flood, for example. That pattern is replicated in every culture. Every culture once had ways of thinking about these things. I think what makes it particularly difficult for us to speak about climate change at our particular time is that, you know, we've become accustomed to thinking in the first place that everything has a sort of easy solution. And in relation to climate change, that's just not the case. And we always, we've been brought up to think over the last 50, 60 years that things always get better. And, you know, when we confront climate change, it's very hard to go forward with that impression. We are suddenly in a world where we realize that what we've actually created is bringing something very dark towards us. And how do we confront that in our psychological states, in our imaginative states? We are not prepared to confront those realities.
I wonder what role you think academics, especially those academics who work outside the hard sciences, what aren't they paying attention to when it comes to our current environmental crisis?
I mean, it's like thousands of things. But one thing which I will perhaps is worth paying attention to is the whole sort of discourse, the whole discussion on climate change tends to be very strangely Eurocentric, you know, in the sense that it's very much focused on, let's say, the developed world, so to speak. It's focused on Europe. It's focused on America. But the real drivers of climate change, as well as the victims of climate change, are not here. They're in Asia. They're in Africa. And I think our whole discussion of this issue has to take into account now that the major issues of climate change will be settled not here, but in Asia, you know, simply because the Asian populations are so dense and so large, and also because Asians are so much exposed to the impacts of, you know, catastrophes.
And in that said, I wonder, as you think about those of us here in the West who have families who may be affected by this, do you feel like Asian political leaders have done at all? Where do you see the leadership coming from when we're talking about political leadership with climate change?
Well, at this particular moment, it seems to be coming from China. You know, the Chinese have been very forward-leaning on climate change. They're moving very fast towards renewables. And especially in these last 2 years, they've been actually seized the initiative on this, you know, which is a curious thing because actually, even though it's clear that Asia will be very badly hit, right now, if you think of 2017, the country that was worst hit by climate change was, in fact, the U.S. You know, you think of, let's say, Hurricane Harvey, Irma,
Maria.
Maria, you think of the wildfires along the west coast, and most of all, you think of what happened to Puerto Rico. You know, Puerto Rico is a part of the richest, most powerful country on earth, and now Puerto Rico has been experiencing one of the greatest depopulation events of modern times. You know.
I'm afraid we're out of time, but I want to thank Amitav Ghosh for being with me. His most recent nonfiction book about this is called The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable. For us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website. 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.